You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Barry, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
My name is Barry Patel. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Galt Companies, which is Galt Pharmaceuticals plus Galt Franchise Systems. And today we're going to talk about how we've built a small pharma company, unlike big pharma, and really built that foundation on working with pharmacies and also working on the principles of entrepreneurism and to franchise the model of pharmaceutical market, pharmaceutical sales by entrepreneurs.
Barry, when I come across your website, I'm picking out a few products that came to my mind from when I was younger in the business, the Norgesic and Doral and things like that. And I'm guessing that your company has either bought the product or bought the name. And I was saying, well, maybe that's a little bit different than some of the bigger pharmacy companies, but a lot of them have bought products and shifted and merged and things like that.
You're exactly right. Heard of those before. So our model is a little bit different. Today, to bring a brand new product to market, it costs about $1 billion, 15 years and so forth. But as pharmacists, we understand there are many products out there that were used back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. But what happens in the pharma industry, you're not marketing a product, turns generic, then physicians are going to forget about it and they're going to the next shinier toy. In fact, that's what happened with the opioid, right? One of the products we picked up, Norgesic, is obviously non-opioid, non-controlled, had great value, patients' treatment, and dispensed it quite a bit. We make sure that there is brand name value. So Norgesic is well known. It's got high recall with healthcare providers. So if we were to go out and market Orfenadrin, aspirin, caffeine, it's crazy. So you still have to have that name attached. Same thing with Doral, because honestly, there's going to be a shortage of more products in the near future. Once products become generic, especially the new ones, forget about them. Manufacturers, not sustainable for them to keep manufacturing. So you'll slowly see products sort of going away. And FDA fees are still there, stringent requirements. But the bigger thing, honestly, also the middlemen are requiring rebates of smaller generics. And so just not sustainable. There are many more products. So what we've done is developed some algorithms clinically to identify some of those products and bring them back to market. We're not just going to bring me two products at a different strength or a different formulation. It's got to have some clear advantages to a patient, key categories that have a lot of churn. That's how we really identify our products.
Barry, I've lost touch of these because, as you say, when the generic comes out, people kind of forget about the brand name. And maybe there's a little bit dormant period in people's minds. And then I see them pop up on your site. Were these drugs that they actually stopped making the brand name for a while? Or were these drugs that maybe the brand name company that I'm thinking you bought them from was just at a lower production of them? And then you got them. And then another question was, when you do get them, are you then taking in the manufacturing of that? Or do you kind of farm that out? Or is the original company still have those on their conveyor belt?
Right. So a lot of the times those companies that own them first, they shelve them. And it's a business decision because they've got other products that are a lot better and they want to focus their efforts there. Once they shelve them, they'll keep the brand name companies. And then once they turn generic, they'll even stop making the brand, that brand, and get promoted anymore. So those generics slowly go down. So sometimes they do go totally off the market. So Norgesic actually was an example of that. The last tablet was in 2013, 2014. We acquired the ANDA on 2017. Took us 2 years to bring it to market. You still had to do some rigorous testing on the product because it hadn't been manufactured in 5 years. That's one of those cases. With case of Doral and with Aurovig, our two other products, they actually were still being made and they were still on the market. You can, in the pharma industry, continue on those supply chain relationships, and it's a lot easier just to take those over. We did with one of the products with Aurovig, double tablet, and it's a little bit difficult to make. But with the others, we don't have our own FDA manufacturing facilities, farm it out, just like a lot of companies do. It's just a lot easier, simpler, and efficient.
You mentioned, Barry, some rules of thumb, name brand recognition and this and that. Are there others that you haven't covered? I'm guessing there's some focus groups. You have to talk to some people and see if they remember this and see if it's worth digging into that again and so on.
honestly, my partner, Wade Smith, he is, if I could call it pharmacy historian, he remembers the brand name of every generic that's out there. He remembers what the pill looks like, what color it was, what the bottle was. He's really our inside AI, if you want to call it that. But then, yes, we do some testing, and mainly with pharmacists, to be quite honest, because pharmacists remember dispensing it sometimes more than the physician prescribing. But there are other clinical variables that we want to put in place. Like I said, that has to be clinical advantage. There has to be additional indications compared to what's already out there, or better safety, or some other things that go along with that. And then the third thing is, you want it to have exclusivity or single source. So there are generics out there that have multiple sources. So Torvastatin is great. Probably 50 companies making that. Then there are other ANDAs where there may be only one or two or three companies making it. And we'll look for ones that where there is only one or two, and the second one may be stopping making it, so we'll have some exclusivity there. So even without having the brand or trade name, you still have some exclusivity there where we can sort of at least promote, and benefits. Promotion does take money, and that's where our franchising concept comes in to help support some of those brand products.
So Barry, if one of your drugs that you picked up now and kind of resurrected, and let's say there used to be 10 generic manufacturers of the drug when it went off patent, let's say 20 years ago. Then it went down to 5, then down to 3, and then down to 1, and then you guys resurrected the brand name. In theory, could all those people, those 10 companies that made that generic, say, all right, we're going to make the generic again, or are they blocked somehow?
No, in theory, if they own the rights to it and they've made it in the past, they can. However, the FDA is going to require formulation studies again.
Barry, with this system, is this ongoing? For example, right now there's a product that came out and it's going to go through the same cycle. And then in 2033, you guys are going to look at it and do the same thing, because there's going to be new old pharmacists. They're going to grow up just like I did, and they're going to remember, oh, I remember way back in the year 2018, there used to be this product. Does this cycle just continue?
Just as long as brand names go generic, generics stop being promoted, they still have clinical value, they start kind of going away, then yeah, it's going to continue on. To have that trade name recognition, it's helpful, right? But there are products that you're seeing all day long in hospital, the shortage of drugs, mostly injectables, and hear about it more and more on the news, a drug shortage of this, that. And it's mainly because a manufacturer stopping to make it, not because, oh, we can't find that. And so there's going to be continued need. I mean, there's a huge issue. You're seeing the biologics are pretty much the only ones that are really receiving promotion. And that's why $500 billion we spend on pharmaceuticals each year, 60% of it's on specialty medication, not on the 90% that are generic.
So in theory, or even in practice, there could be a generic that is kind of the same as all the stuff you're doing, but instead of somebody resurrecting it with an old name brand, they might even resurrect it with a new name brand.
Yeah. I think there's some rules around that with the FDA. They'd have to file it as an actual trade name in a different way. So
yep, that makes sense.
So, like I said, the trade name isn't as important as what we feel is really the clinical benefit. Are there any clinical advantages to this over something else? And that's going to also help make sure that insurance companies are going to cover it, because patients have been through two or three medications for migraines or for pain or infections, whatever.
There might be sometimes, I imagine, where let's say there's a migraine medicine out that it's out in generic and nobody wants to really do much with it yet because the brand name stopped being promoted. Everybody kind of forgets about it. There's all the new stuff going on. It might still be effective, but a good effective part of it too is it might be affordable, right? Because some of these new ones come out, and if the generic goes away because no one cares about it and the new biologicals are out, you might bring something out that's still effective and it might be more affordable.
100%. Absolutely. I mean, because promotions that go into some of the biologics, plus there are more expensive to make, the price is going to be high. Whereas promote it more efficiently, is where our franchise model comes into play, where we kind of work with entrepreneurs to build their territories, and also the fact that we'd be a lot more efficient.
And I know we're going to talk about your franchises, but in the meantime, how many products could Galt itself handle? All of a sudden, some old wise man said, these 10 products are going to be great because there's no way of a pharmacist coming in. And these are the kind of people that like vinyl records and kind of nostalgia. How many could you guys handle or even want of these? Your company has 3 or 4 or something. And how many could you take on without stressing you guys too much or stressing the business too much?
We're in 3 different markets: sleep, pain, then oral infection. So as long as they're within certain baskets and therapeutic categories, you can scale. So that way, say, for example, a pain doctor, okay, I've got 5 medications that you could potentially want. And so you can scale the right way.
Barry, how all of us pharmacies, where we always bitch about the PBMs. Is there anything in your company that you think is so unfair with these big manufacturers and this isn't right that they get to do this and we get to do that? Or is it all bonus? Is it all, hey, the bigger they are, the more nimble we are?
I mean, pharma has had to play with, yeah, they've sort of made them dependent on it. If you want on formulary, if you want access, you got to go through us. It sort of hurts the smaller company. So if in that sense, the other way around. But as far as what they're doing, I mean, I started out my career with a big pharma, Merck. And so not that they're doing anything that isn't right. They're bringing great products to market, but they've had to work in an environment created by the PBMs. So until that gets fixed, which I think too far, unless the whole thing has to be reversed, then it's going to be an issue.
Barry, how'd you get into this? I mean, most people in pharmacy school, I know at least I'm not thinking that someday I'm going to own a name brand. How did this come about? This thought even?
You know what? If you had asked me that when I graduated, I wouldn't have thought that either. Because I was leaning more on the research side. I got into clinical research, internships, went straight into pharma, and then more of a medical affairs roles. But then my entrepreneurism took over in the late 90s, started a company in the outcomes research world where we collect data from medical records and basically made that analyzed and educated healthcare providers, show them comparative effectiveness research back in the day and out there prescribing guidelines. And so that was valuable for pharma companies to sponsor, but also insurance companies to make formulas. So I kind of got a good global view of the pharma industry, healthcare providers, how decisions get made. And once I successfully was able to sell that company, worked out my employment agreement, then teamed up with Wade, who is a pharma veteran, so knows the ins and outs. And so we got together and I brought
more of my clinical and AI background with that and then had the pharma.
It was great because when you own a product, you're actually owning an asset. That's what he's taught me and that's what it is. When it's a service company, which my past company was much more of a service company, you're constantly pitching for the next project. That project was over 6 months, the research project. Okay, now I got to go get another one. And I was head of sales for that. So it wasn't as scalable, however, pharma products are. So that's where I really thought about getting much more potential.
You hear about people that are finally hoping to get a brand name, whether it's a tennis shoe or, and it's usually an older brand name. I've seen it before, just never in pharmacy. What do you imagine is the most dead that a product would be? I'm being a little bit figurative here, but coming across it in a library and you say, oh, this was a big product back in the 70s. And like, you can't find it. You don't know even who has the patent. There's no building. It hasn't been touched. And there's maybe some 90-year-old lady that has the rights to it that's got one foot in the grave. I mean, is a product ever that dead, or are you always dealing with something a little bit that has more to it?
Yeah. So Mike, that's where the clinical part comes in, that you want to make sure that there's still value to that product. There are some that just are dead and they need to stay dead.
If it's totally dead, there's probably no value, or else somebody would have done something with it.
Maybe, because there's always some value, but there are some that are just so outdated. So you think about some of the diuretics that from the 70s and 80s to manage blood pressure. Well, there are no ACE inhibitors or even ARBs out there back in those days. And so now there are a lot more better medications. So no sense in bringing some of those categories back. But let's take an example, right? There was a product for gout. It was kind of going downhill because there are other products out there. But all of a sudden, company study for prevention of heart attacks, a lower dose, anti-inflammatory effects, and voila. There are products that have other value. And so the other piece when we're evaluating products is that are there other values been identified?
What's the worst part of your week right now in your job? What hour or two do you not like during the week?
Supply chain has been a big issue here just post-COVID. We have to pay higher fees, distribution fees, and so forth. That's why our model is such that almost 90% of our business now is shipped directly to independent pharmacies. Got the largest 3PL in the country that does that for us, so we don't touch any product. Independent pharmacy sets up an account on our e-commerce website, order just like they're ordering from Amazon.
Years ago, this is like 20 years ago, we'd buy direct from Merck. I don't know if a lot of pharmacies do that now, but we used to always time it. The Merck guy would come by, you'd get 2% discount, lower than even the wholesalers, and you had all these light green and white bottles on your shelf, and you'd always plan it this way. So now you mentioned that some people buy direct from you. You cut out the middleman of the wholesaler. So that might give a little bit of a discount to the pharmacy. How does that play out with the PBM? I imagine if the PBM covers it, that's probably an issue. And then secondly, if the PBM does pay for it, in this case, the pharmacy might be buying a little bit better than somebody else would if they're going through a wholesaler. So there might be a little bit more of a spread there, I imagine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why we did establish our direct buy program. Merck, I think, was one of the only companies that did a direct buy selling program.
It might have
program.
Been like Merck and Lilly Upjohn or something. I forget who, like two of them.
Yeah, but our reasons are different just because we have control of product and we can support them as well as, like you said, provide it the right discount. Pharmacy benefit manager is going to reimburse based upon the reference pricing, based on the contracts. If they're part of a PSAO, it might be different. And there's so many factors, so we don't control that. We don't know what they make. But all we know is that we can sell it to them cheaper than they could buy it, or at least the same price, but without discounts. That's one way to really help the pharmacy community, especially in this day of negative reimbursements. They make products that can help them.
And you got all these discounts going everywhere else. It's kind of nice to have pharmacies in there as well. And you do have a price to compare it to, because the wholesalers, I imagine they carry some of your product, but most of your customers are going direct.
Correct. With 90%. 90% are going direct, and we're slowly cutting all of our products out of the wholesaler.
And how does that work with the PBMs? If you have a new product come out, new in quotes, one of the newer older products, is that something that your company has to do to try to get on their formularies? Or is that something that kind of naturally happens in the industry when a new brand name comes out? How does that work?
Honestly, Mike, if you're not a $3 or $5 generic, that's the only thing PBMs are really covering. They're restricting everything else anyway. So we just really take what we can get from the coverage. And it's been because there are pharmacy benefit managers that value product for just within a certain category that need. I'll give you an example, Humira. Humira is a top-selling drug for the last 10 years, but every one of those patients gets a prescription for Humira. They have to go through a prior authorization process and have layered the clinical information sent and necessity, and did they try all the other rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis drugs? Yes, maybe our providers have to go through it sometimes, and so there is a little bit work for them to get it approved. That's why we work with physicians.
Even though it's a national product, it's kind of like more of a fit for certain doctors and patients and so on. When they know more about it, the more knowledge is better for them.
Then they're providing extra value to their patients. Doctor, neurologist, tried so many different things and they want to give something to their patient. Finally, this will work for you and it is working. So do what it takes to be on it. So that's where insurance can't say, okay, we're going to deny this.
All right. So Barry, looking at your website and so on, we alluded to it earlier. Tell me about how this whole franchise system works out.
Sure. Franchise concept, obviously, been around for years. It's never been applied to pharmaceuticals, similar to a McDonald's or a Subway or a hotel or a fitness gym in that sense. But what we are franchising is, first of all, the exclusive rights to market our products within their territory. And we help support the education in those specific territories. We have 500 territories across the U.S., 500 to 700,000 population in each, 500 healthcare provider prescribers. And so we demographics and different types of prescribers are split up. We provide prescribing data to show what they're currently prescribing in the pain category, sleep category, or in the oral anti-infective category, and they are able to evaluate and they pay us a franchise fee. The training, the process of how they can succeed as their own pharma company without having all the hassles of being a pharma company in terms of regulatory, safety, manufacturing, and supply chain, we've got all that taken care of.
Oh, now that's really interesting. And the people who are doing this, is it derogatory to call them sales reps, or can I still call them that?
No. I mean, I think they're fine with it.
They're fine. As long as they're pulling in some money, they don't care, right?
Society, you do have to be careful about what you label people these days. But sales rep is still the okay word.
They can take it. The people that are doing that, I imagine once they've crossed that bridge, that they're not getting paid 80% from one of the big manufacturers, and this is a little thing on the side. Are they leaving their other full-time gig?
The ones that are signing up and coming franchisees are those that have sold in the past, have relationships, and they have either been laid off or sick and tired of it. They're high-performing sales folks, but have not been valued financially, whereas we provide an uncapped revenue potential. So that's one thing that's appealing. So they do full-time, or if they are still in the industry, they'll hire somebody under them to do day-to-day selling and run their company that way. They may be executive or different level and have some folks. The other types, independent pharmacy owners, are franchise owners. First franchisees had were independent pharmacy owners and still continue to be good franchisees for us because they know healthcare. They know the products. A lot have marketing reps already out promoting their pharmacy and services. So they'll just get them trained up on product. And as long as they promote according to our regulatory guideline, our marketing materials, and we are very stringent on that, by the way. So regardless if you're a sales rep or a pharmacy owner that has hired a rep, they have to go through our training, get certified. And then we have a third type that are just investors, entrepreneur. They like the concept of owning a small pharma company in their community, and they want somebody else to manage it, and they'll bring on a management company or some professional.
Would you picture somebody, whoever they are, whether they own it or whether they work for somebody who owns it or whether they hired a sales team or something, would you imagine, though, that one person could keep busy with that one product, that would be their full-time job? Would that be something that happens, or do you think that would be like, oh no, that's only this many hours a week, Mike, you'd have to have other stuff too?
Absolutely, they could make a living and make a really good living on just one product. We have three of them, by the way, but even if they just sold one of our three and created that system where you have about 15, 20 accounts, visit them weekly, kind of like you're a fixture in that office, work with all the staff and do what it takes to constantly remind them that they can do it with one product. Those that are working with all three products, especially primary care, is a great target. We have a sleep drug, which has clinical advantages. We have the pain drug, obviously, we have oral infection. They can hit all three drugs at once. So if you've got a few of those good offices, getting different prescriptions.
That's really interesting. So what are some numbers with this? And I guess those numbers would be, how many franchisees do you have under some of these products?
Sure. So we've got 500 territories across the U.S. broken up by population, graphics, prescribers, and currently have 59 territories that are sold. There's about 28 owners, so there are multiple territories that are owned.
I'm sure you've done something with this. if you have a territory out in the Rocky Mountains, there might be an 85-year-old doctor in his cabin. Our territory is based on numbers of people. And I imagine if there's an area that's not as dense, that the price goes down or something like that. How do you divide that up?
So they are pretty much equally divided by number of prescribers, as well as population. It ends up being about 500,000 to 750,000 based on that. And then we'll look at a mix of other things, types of prescribers, as well as insurance coverage and so forth. And so when it comes to the price is the same, the franchise fee, but we may add, if they want to buy two or three and we want to bundle them together, because of some of the difference it will produce.
And typically, is the same person owning the three products in the area, or do you have some where somebody owns one and someone else owns the other two?
No, that's the idea of this. Once you buy the territory, you get rights to all three products, and even better, any future product that Galt brings out. So you have a 10-year franchise agreement, so anything else, option after 10 years.
What has the breakdown been as far as sales reps themselves, those who just own it, those who might own a pharmacy, and so on?
I'd say half of our owners are independent pharmacy, because again, they understand it. They're more bullish on prescription. And then the other 50% are probably owner-operated sales reps, ex-reps that want to kind of get into business, and then sort of investors.
Part of me says, yeah, these people are selling it, but they have a vested interest in this. It's like, are they putting the best out there? Just any business, any salesperson is trying to push their product. I mean, they're not lying about it, but they're trying to put their best foot forward. And so whether it's working for some corporation that you have no idea what the owners are doing, or whether it's somebody local who owns it, yeah, they're going to put their best foot forward. And pharmacists are so good at this, of thinking like not talking money, like there's something wrong with money and profit and ownership and things like that. But what better person to buy from or be sold from, the owner or some New York corporation hedge fund kind of thing?
That's right. So that is something that teach our franchisees to put out there, that we're a small business, I'm local, I'm going to respond to needs here. And the main thing is, and this is core, is you put the patient first. Always put the patient first. And the profits will follow. We always know that here, money will follow. But our drugs are great, but they're not for everybody. So you can't look at it, can't drive it like a salesperson try to hit a bonus next quarter, next year. If you're looking at it for a long-term relationship with a good healthcare provider office and building that relationship, there will be future products, then that's how we really help our owners train.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that about saying that we're locally owned and so on. So that's not something that you're trying to hide or play down or anything like that?
We actually play it up. They use that to their benefit, that, oh, they're a smaller company, I'm a small business, check out my website here or whatever. It's real. They could see that, wow, that person's just like me. And we'll actually target those kinds of healthcare providers that are not part of health systems, but are still sort of surviving themselves as an independent practitioner or a smaller specialty or so forth. They get it. They know that that is something that they understand, the smallness of it.
Barry, I'm trying to figure out though how I would feel. And I know it's just something inside of me that if I was like selling something, and it's an odd thing inside of me. Let's say I own my pharmacy, which I do. And let's say I own one of these products. If I go to the doctor and I say, hey, I'm part-time sales guy and I'm part-time pharmacy owner, I like to get out in the field and things like this. It seems strange to me if I was pushing my own product that I owned. It seems more strange to me than if I was hired by one of the big manufacturers and I was trying to press their product. I don't know why that seems odd at all to me, because both companies I've got a financial interest in, whether I own the company or not. I think it's just that weird guilt of pharmacists that we think everybody should come before us, and we think we should get screwed by everybody. And if there's anything left, then we can maybe screw someone else. But, you know, it's just a weird feeling that pharmacists have.
No, you're right. It's been years and years as a profession, because we're always at a grocery store or a pharmacy or an independent pharmacy and don't ask for anything more. And then when it comes to making a profit or at least promoting something, yeah, there is that we hear that all the time, that I don't like to be a salesperson. I don't like, okay, but yet they still will market their store, brings foot traffic. They'll still go out to the aisle and show them which supplement is better for memory versus not. They'll still promote a compound that they make, which may not have FDA clinical studies. How is this any different? In fact, there's a lot of data on the products that they would be promoting, and they should be ethically only for patients that are going to benefit. And they you know, that's obviously the whole reason they got into pharmacy, is to make sure patients got the right medication, right dose, right time. And so the beauty about this franchise model is that prescription doesn't even have to go to their pharmacy. It could be sent to the pharmacy down the street, their independent pharmacy. They could be helping them out because they will make a little bit more than probably other products, but also they'll still gain the other part. So if they feel kind of dirty about sending prescriptions to their own pharmacy, they can do that. Or we have national central hub pharmacy that can send prescriptions there.
It's interesting, because out of all the things that people sell, what product is more black and white or has more research or more regulation than a drug like this? I mean, there's a million things that any business can sell. And if I said which product is probably black and white, that you're not selling directly to a little old lady, you're selling it to a well-trained and educated physician. If you want a product that you own that's at arm's length, kind of, it would be a product like this, with the FDA in the middle of it, with the AMA or physicians in the middle of it, PBMs in the middle of it.
Exactly. The decision to prescribe is obviously the prescriber, PA, nurse practitioner, doctor, and you leave it up to them. All you have to do is educate. As a pharmacist, we're restricted on what and how we can promote to them. So yeah, it's the same. But yeah, like I said, there could be an unproven supplement that is going to make a $20 margin on that they're happy to sell. And that's directly to the patient.
This is an FDA product through the doctor. So you've already put a few, not hurdles, but what would you call it? A few safety steps or processes or something between a typical company and the consumer. Barry, when you started this company, was this part of your model right away, or did this come on later?
It came on later. So our initial model, our first product was Doral, the sleep drug. And honestly, it was purely to work with independent pharmacies and allow them to see clinical benefits. There's so many patients on Ambien that are literally hooked on Ambien and they're getting crazy side effects. And so this was a product that the pharmacists could hopefully educate their healthcare providers on, that there's an alternative now. So that was our model. We saw that, okay, we've got to have other sales activities, traditional sales activities, sales force, marketing rep, sales rep, call them. We didn't want to go out and raise funding through private equity or just become one of them again, pharma. We said, there's another way. We could have partnerships with those selling. We have those partnerships, either distributorship or we could franchise it. There's enough here to franchise because we've already done the proof of concept and have some territories that are successful with sales reps that we put in. And we're not reinventing the wheel. Pharmaceutical sales has been done for 50, 60, 70 years. Detail reps first came out. And so it's just refining it.
I know you didn't recreate the model of reps, but this franchise thing, it must have been a lot of legal hoops and contract questions and things like that. It seems like you would have had to think, like, this has never been done really before. And was that a lot of work? And did you get stung ever in something where you said, no one ever thought about that? We sold this, but we never came across this question kind of thing.
Yes. You think the pharma industry is highly regulated? Franchising industry is just as or even more regulated, because you're selling a business. So all of those things go with disclosures, and this could fail and this could happen. So all of that we had to learn quickly and build our franchise disclosure documents, 120 pages. So a prospective franchisee reads those and understands it, and the franchise agreement's about 30 pages long. Lawyers involved, obviously, in building that and doing that. But I think to your point, more been in pharma, myself, Wade, both of us have been in pharma. We know it's highly regulated. How do we transfer that important safety and regulatory and saying the right word to business owner, entrepreneur, that is profit motivated? How do we make sure we do that? And that's through our training process. We have a very strong training system that trains them on the product, but also on what they can say, can't say. Our certification process is really rigorous when it comes to that, just like other pharma. And then various quality checks. So that was our biggest legal sort of scares, that what if that happens? But then the other part of it is that it's the same thing that happened to big pharma. So if there is a rep at Amgen or Lilly or Merck that starts talking off-label, then yeah, that rep's going to get fired or reprimanded or however. In our case, we have the threat in their territory away.
And I imagine that legal-wise, they're not the... I mean, let's say that... I don't want to put these thoughts in your head, Barry, but I'm sure you've come across
them. Don't worry.
Them.
Those are the ones that keep me up at 3 a.m. I know exactly where you're going.
What happens if all of a sudden you buy one and for some odd reason there's birth defects and they might have happened in the past, but there was something weird about some legal this or that. And all of a sudden, you've got $1 billion lawsuit on your hands because of something like that. Who owns the liability? Is that part of the sales, the franchises? And then do they have insurance on that? How does that all work out?
Yeah, so we own that liability. It's our product. We own it. The FDA is going to come to us and say, hey, this product needs to be removed from the market because of this, or there's been some lawsuit to that. So that goes into the due diligence process of acquiring a product, obviously. And so when they have been on the market for many years, it's easier to sort of check that out as opposed to something that's been out there a couple of years. One of our biggest line items on our operating budget is our liability insurance. So we have to protect ourselves, but we also protect our franchisee because they're the ones that are going to be hurt if something like that happened. They do still have to carry other professional liability because we can't control. They do something they're not supposed to, harassment or whatever. They have to protect that way because employment law is such that they are not an employee. So we're protected that way, but they themselves are an entity, just like a restaurant, Subway franchise. That franchise has to take care of their own issues.
So Barry, what's the next step with products? I imagine you say, hey, we covered these three things. Let's maybe cover this disease state and so on. Are you guys just like flipping through the internet? Do you have an official system in place where you're going through each drug patent from this year to this year and doing this? Or is it just, hey, we should look into this. We remember this product. Some of the pharmacists told us about this.
It's a little bit of all of the above there because that nostalgic part of it, that last point you talked about. But yes, there is a system. Now we've known what works. There are a lot of products we've had to say no to because it didn't meet certain criteria. So we've kind of formalized it a little bit more. I'm not saying we're applying an AI engine or anything like that. It's more just our own experience and things like that. And then, like I said, products that have value in other use cases is very important too. Doing the studies, the clinical studies to prove that it would help certain patients with other conditions that would help patients. That's the next level. Products is obviously something that's a continuous process. And we get approached by other companies also that's interested in this.
Seeing if you want to buy something.
Yeah, that wasn't the case when we first started. So now that we've gotten some more folks out there and some traction and some processes and some structure, it's nice that get our calls returned if we were interested in products.
What do most of your days look like during the week, Barry? Are you in meetings? Are you talking to your franchisees? What does your week sort of look like?
I'm so grateful and blessed to have an amazing team that day-to-day part of it is less. I mean, things just get done. It's magical to me. We've got great operationals, processes. We've got a sales leader. We've got somebody supporting our franchisees. And I love to get out there. Like, I'm in Austin today just because visiting one of our hub pharmacy franchisee out here. But it's more on strategy for the next thing within the franchise model. What else can we be doing to help support our franchisee through different avenues like direct consumer, telehealth, fits within our product. So partnerships such as that, creating some strategic alliance partnerships, I enjoy, but I'm still involved in the day-to-day quite a bit. I'll join calls, but I'll let the team sort of take the lead on the majority.
Your entrepreneurial dreams, Barry, where does this go now 5 to 10 years? Does this just keep growing, or do you see yourself with other interests that you also want to tackle in the industry or a different industry? What is your personal projection with your next half dozen years?
It's definitely to continue growing that pipeline and franchise model. You know, we've only captured 10% of the country. So dream would be to really grow that model across country where there's entrepreneurs all running their own mini pharma companies and are able to achieve their dreams financially as well as satisfaction they're doing in their communities. So that's what it would be. And that might take ultimately to bring in some investment partners, held off for so long, wanted to kind of build it. We're profitable. So it's something that now we're getting the interest of investors that want to take this to the next level. So we're open to hear how that's done. And as long as we can continue to part of clinical and the significance of what happened, what types of products and how we work, you know, we have no egos. If somebody else wants to come in and help run the company and make it better, we're happy to do that. So that's probably more of the next 1 to 3 year plan. And then beyond that, it's really, how do we scale this to make it even bigger?
Boy, Barry, thanks for joining us. That was really interesting. First of all, I don't usually talk to old independent pharmacists like myself. I know a lot of it. It's kind of boring. And then some of the things I maybe talk to people on, I've got a little handle on it, but we want to go into more details. But every once in a while, we get something like this where it's something totally different to think about this, owning the individual franchises of a drug like that. So really cool stuff. And it's really cool to see where something like this is going to go. Thanks for your time, Barry. And best wishes to you. It's exciting. Keep it going.
Thank you so much. Thank you for allowing me to tell our story, because it is different and it's hard to sometimes just say in 30 seconds or 2 minutes. So sometimes it does take a conversation. This is the podcast to do that. So appreciate what you're doing for the profession of pharmacy and bringing awareness to different opportunities, but also for the independent pharmacy world. I love all of the podcasts that you do. I try to catch up with every one of them. And it was really a true honor that we got to be part of one.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.